Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. Bob is off on assignment today, but I am joined by Matthew Wolf, who is a reporter. His reporting has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, The Atlantic, National Geographic, and The New Republic. He also has a PhD in sociology from NYU and is currently a fellow at NYU's Institute for Public Knowledge. Matt, part related to what we're going to talk about, I think in 2022, you wrote a piece in New York Times Magazine called The Rise and Fall of America's Environmentalist Underground, which seems to be a bit of a precursor for the book that we're going to be talking about, which is Fires in the Night, the Earth Liberation Front, the FBI, and the Secret History of Eco-Sabotage. Welcome to Green and Red.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. I've enjoyed reading the book. And Fires in the Night is a story of the ELF's rise and unraveling, stretching from old growth forests in the Pacific Northwest and radical forest movement, which we saw in the 90s and into the 2000s to the WTO protests in Seattle. But the book really digs into the Earth Liberation Front, particularly the cell, as I think you refer to it in Eugene. But maybe we could just, and also the other thing I'll say in, as part of the intro, is that we're starting to see some of the worst aspects of the climate crisis really begin to unravel. And so I would say that this has become the sort of spirit of the times, is that I think people are reconsidering and redebating the ELF. And we're seeing that in literature, we're seeing that in pop culture, we're seeing that in movement circles. But maybe we could just start off with, and we'll talk more about current stuff, but maybe we could just start off a little bit. Why did you decide to write this book?
So I'd always been really interested in the ELF. I remember I grew up on the West Coast, and actually in the Bay Area in Marin County. And I grew up in a Marin County liberal household where I think my local public school taught environmentalism, taught Save the Rainforest. And it was that thing of growing up of where my generation was being taught that there was a number of huge environmental crises that we were all facing. And just whether it was global warming, whether it was acid rain, whether it was destruction of the rainforest, whether it was just infinite types of pollution, and these colossal crises, and then these very sort of small scale solutions that were being offered as a way of addressing them, like being told, so don't take long showers, be sure to turn off the lights when you leave a room, recycle your cans. And even when I was younger, I remember there being a kind of cognitive dissonance about that. And I remember as a teenager seeing news reports about the Earth Liberation Front, which was this mysterious band of activists or vigilantes who were setting things on fire, which for a teenage boy is pretty interesting all by itself. But I remember thinking, I really appreciated that there was somebody who was taking this disjunction between the scale of the crisis and the solutions. I was taking the crisis really seriously and was trying to do something that was commensurate with its severity. And so I had always been really interested in them. And then, as you suggest, came this moment some years back where a number of the ELF, after they got broken up, went on the run or went on the lam. And the FBI spent a few years kind of picking them off and trying to arrest them. And one member of the ELF, Joseph Dibby, was arrested, I think, 2018, 2019, and while he was actually going through Cuba. And it gave a moment, a news peg, to go back and reassess the ELF, as you suggest, who were, when they were active, were widely mocked and were considered completely ridiculous radicals who were not particularly serious. But as you say, as the climate crisis has intensified and become something that we're all too familiar with, and we've really seen it become, it's very hard to have it not be part of your life at this point. I think there's been a moment to reassess who the ELF was and what they were doing and how to think about it now.
Just to dig in a little bit into the ELF, the story centers around five or six main figures, three of which are like the founders and then other people who joined later who were like very involved. And then I noted a quote from Mike German, who talked about the FBI being very intrigued by the ELF. They had spent the part of the 80s politically going after neo-Nazis, the 90s going after militias, who they, I think I've heard Mike German say that before too, is they write them off as just a bunch of idiots. But I'd be curious about how the folks in which you focus on in the book, who are like the sort of core to the Eugene cell, how they, what made them more intriguing? How did they differ demographically than the white supremacist element, for example?
They were, I think, you mean interesting to the FBI or interesting to me or?
Either.
Yeah. So the, what was it? I think that the FBI, as you said, so the FBI came down really hard on the ELF, particularly after 9/11, when there was this, when the FBI transformed from what had been traditionally a crime-fighting agency into a counterterrorism organization. That was their mandate. They took on thousands of new agents whose only job was to basically go after terrorists. And I think what made the ELF interesting to the FBI was in part that they didn't know much about the ELF at that point. They didn't know much about radical environmentalism in general. It was an unknown quantity to them. I think one of the things that really spooked the FBI was the fact that the FBI has always been really hard on leftist movements, and they've always had a real bias in that regard. I think that one thing that differed, that made the ELF different, was clearly that they were educated, and clearly that they were trying to take on the state. Some of the communiques that they issued were very much openly against, were openly hostile to government, openly hostile to corporations. And I think they seemed like a bigger threat in that regard than some of the white nationalist groups or some of the anti-abortion groups that had a horrific, but in some ways more conservative goals, or things that didn't seem quite the same kind of threat that the ELF did. And I think it was also something about the concept of, there was a concept, one that was born by industrial groups, of eco-terrorism. There's this idea that eco-terrorism was a concept that any property destruction done in defense of the environment, whether it be it graffiti, be it small-scale vandalism, rose to the level of terrorism. And that was largely because there was a name for it. So everything fell under that umbrella in a way that violence or property destruction committed in support of, say, anti-abortion actions was not. There's no sort of word for abortion terrorism in quite the same way. So it was something where I think after 9/11, when the FBI was going around looking for terrorism, eco-terrorism was right there.
And it also, the other thing that really strikes me in like doing the back to like deep background on some of these figures is they very much start out from caring individuals to activists like animal rights activists. Kevin Tubbs is definitely an animal rights activist. Others are involved in like forest stuff. And then they eventually like transition here. Is there anything you want to say on that? Because I think that's an important point too, compared to anti-abortion. Yes, or white supremacists.
I think you're totally right. I think a lot of it, the folks that I talked to in the ELF when I did interviews with people who'd been members of the group, a lot of them talked about it. All of them effectively started out as activists who were trying to make change through, in quotation marks, legitimate means. And people were trying to make change through petitioning or through legal protests or lobbying and got really frustrated. And I think a lot of it came from their desire to protect the earth came from a place of love for a lot of them. Kevin Tubbs just started out as a guy who grew up in Omaha, Nebraska, to a conservative family, but he lived in a house that was filled with dogs, and he really just fell in love with animals. And it led him to this set of questions about, if I love dogs, why do I get to eat meat? And if we privilege one animal, why don't we privilege all animals? And if that's the case, if why don't, maybe it's important that we do something. And people would have, I think, other members of the group really love trees or really love natural landscapes. So I think it came from a place of love and anger and desperation.
In polls, nature ranks high as things that people love.
Yeah.
And then there's also the part of the origin story of the Eugene Sow of the ELF is very much around Warner Creek. And so we've had other guests on and talked about Warner Creek and related to this, but could you talk a little bit about the significance of Warner Creek to the formation of the ELF? But then also just if you want to say anything about how it's significant to the kind of radical environmental movement in the Northwest at large.
Totally. So I should step back a second and say that a large part of the book and takes place in Eugene, Oregon, which is where a lot of the members of this cell were from or lived. And Eugene, Oregon is this funny place where capitalism and the logging industry comes crashing into radicalism. The University of Oregon that's there has a long, rich radical tradition dating back to the 60s in which they'd protest, you know, the Vietnam War, sometimes through arson, actually. But Eugene was also historically a logging town. There were a lot of mills around there. Cascadia Forest, which is to the east, produces a huge amount of timber every year. And so those two things were thrown into friction. And so a lot of people, Eugene ended up being a center of the radical environmentalism movement. And it attracted a lot of activists there who were ready to show up and, as one put it, just fuck shit up.
Yeah.
And a lot of people ended up, one of the main, so it was already a center of radical environmentalism in the mid-90s. And then in 1995, a large portion of Cascadia National Forest burned under very mysterious circumstances. It was suggested that it had happened because the logging industry had, somebody had set fire to it to take advantage of a clause in logging regulations where old growth forests could not be logged except if they'd been the subject of a fire. So it was an idea, it was a loophole to allow logging companies to get in there and have access to trees that they wouldn't otherwise. So in at the same time, the Clinton administration changed a rule that allowed this portion of the forest around Warner Creek to be logged. So a number of local activists who were already very sensitized to these issues got very upset and marched into the forest and set up a blockade on a logging road that effectively prevented trucks from going up and taking trees. And a number of people who were in that group, many of whom stayed there in kind of a fortress-like structure they built on and off for about a year, ended up in the ELF. And it started, I think, Warner Creek was ultimately successful. They convinced the Clinton administration to roll back this rule and prevent Warner Creek from being logged. So on one hand, it was this incredible victory against the timber industry. On the other hand, people who participated in the blockade were aware that Warner Creek was something that couldn't be replicated very well. It had taken them a year of almost consistent occupation to get this one small rule change pushed through. And they were very aware that they couldn't occupy every logging road everywhere, and that a rule that was rolled back could also be put forward again, as we're seeing in the Trump administration now. So I think for a lot of them, even as it was a victory, it inculcated the sense that what they were doing just wasn't enough and they really needed to do something different. They needed a change in tactics and strategy.
And a number of the core founders of the ELF were at Warner Creek.
Yeah, Jacob Ferguson, Kevin Tubbs, Josephine Overaker, all of them took turns either appeared at Warner Creek or spent long periods of time occupying it.
And just to also this background, and we've done many shows on this with some early Earth Firsters, but Earth First was like a major factor in what happened at Warner Creek. It's also a major factor in what was happening in the forest defense movement in the Northwest.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You have obviously a very educated audience about these things, but Earth First was at that point, the Earth First Journal was headquartered in Eugene, and Earth First had emerged a little bit more than a decade earlier as the pioneers of radical environmentalism, this kind of pushback against more compromise oriented, more corporate mainstream environmentalism, sort of based in DC, which was very much, and everybody who was in the ELF more or less either came out directly out of Earth First or was inspired by them. Whereas in some ways, the ELF was a intensification of the ELF's, or excuse me, of Earth First's tactics and their philosophy. If the Earth First was doing prankish monkey wrenching, the ELF with its arsons was just taking things to the next level.
They're all inspired at some level, not totally, but by Ed Abbey's The Monkey Wrench Gang, which I believe they do arson in the book.
I think they do a little bit of fires, not at the level of the ELF, but yeah.
It's been a minute since I've read it.
It's been a minute since I've read it too. But yeah, everybody, I think that was the text more than any other that people turned back to, or particularly for Earth First, but I know that a lot of folks in the ELF were also more than familiar with that book.
And my other question here is, we have this massive radical militant forest movement. There's also a pretty big militant radical animal rights movement, which also some of the cell are affiliated with. And it's part of what happens when they begin organizing as the ELF, they drop out of those movements. And can you talk about that? Why did they do that?
Yeah. So a lot of, it's a really interesting point. A lot of them were above ground activists, but they were also very aware that above ground activists would get surveilled or would get police attention or would get routinely arrested just in the course of doing protests or doing civil disobedience. So a lot of them, when they decided to go in on the ELF, realized that to avoid drawing attention to themselves, it was better to drop out of the above ground movements and cut ties with other activists. So the ELF actually, the people who were in the group were very careful about who they socialized with, were very careful about avoiding even socializing with each other too much as a way of trying to make sure that they didn't end up on law enforcement's radar as the kind of person who would be a likely suspect for some of these crimes.
And as they shift into this underground cell model, what were some of the key elements to the organizing the cell?
So I think one of the things that was interesting I learned was that part of the reason the ELF didn't get caught for so many years was they were really good students of the FBI and of ways in which the federal government had traditionally tried to subvert radical movements. So they were very careful about what they called OPSEC, which was short for operational security. So they took a lot
also called security culture. No, I'm sorry.
Security culture was also the other word that they used. Yeah. So security culture is basically just a shorthand for trying to keep an eye out for the cops and avoiding them. And a lot of them were deep into this. So first off, when they'd bring people into the ELF, they would have to be vouched for. They'd really have to be somebody who everybody knew or had a track record in the movement. They also had, first off, a really strict rule about not talking about being in the ELF with anybody. And that meant loved ones, that meant colleagues. They were very careful about that. And actually created problems later in that they wouldn't even really discuss, after they'd done a fire, they wouldn't even really discuss it amongst themselves. And that actually created a problem later on in the sense that you want to be able to work out and refine your tactics as you go along. And in this case, they were so careful about security culture that they actually didn't do that. But in terms of the actual actions themselves, they would do things like just make sure that there was absolutely no forensic data on the device, on the incendiary devices, which meant wiping everything down with alcohol. They were very careful about avoiding security cameras. They'd drive to arsons. They paid for things in cash or shoplifted it, so there's no record. In terms of communication, they'd either do dead drop emails or they'd do there used to be voicemail services where you could leave messages for people, but to avoid having like an actual email or phone connection that the FBI could potentially look at and draw connections between different activists with. So they were very careful.
And as far as, let's call it, decision-making went, when we look at other radical groups that the FBI went after, like thinking about the Black Panthers, thinking about the American Indian Movement, there was a hierarchy in those groups, whereas there's like less of a hierarchy within this.
Yeah, totally. A lot of these folks came out of anarchist movements or were familiar with consensus, and they brought that ethic into the group. There was no official hierarchy. Obviously, some people had been in the group longer than others or had more experience. But when it came to picking targets, it was something where folks would discuss it and everybody would have to agree on what they were going to burn down. And in turn, and sometimes people didn't agree and they'd have to pick something else. But it really was founded on the idea of trying to have a egalitarian, non-hierarchical group, which makes it very different than both a number of other political movements. And certainly there was a kind of paramilitary quality to the ELF, but again, one that was done without any kind of hierarchy.
The lack of hierarchy, or it's more of a horizontal decision-making model. That's one of the things that made it more difficult for the FBI as well. Is that right?
Yeah, totally. And it was something where it was like one of the things, I think one of the things that was difficult for the FBI and for prosecutors to understand, even after the arrests, was that the ELF wasn't really a group per se. It was in the same way that you have membership cards or a continuous, consistent number of members. You would have people would come together to do an action, and then they'd break up and not really talk to each other again until there was another action. And it was a sort of rotating cast of characters. You might be involved for a few actions, then go away for a little bit. You might be involved in one here, one there. But it was not something where it had the kind of permanent structure of other kinds of political movements or other kinds of criminal organizations. That was really hard. That made them, as you say, really hard to catch because there was a sort of amorphous quality to them. It was very different than one of the FBI agents on the case. It got his start in the Bureau by looking at the mob. And it was very different than that, which was hierarchical and had consistent membership. And everybody was hanging out in the same places over a consistent period of time. So yeah, you're absolutely right. It made them incredibly difficult to catch.
It's not dissimilar from Antifa, which is as the Trump administration's trying to elevate and prioritize within the government right now.
Yeah, and again, something where the Trump administration also has a very difficult time kind of understanding what Antifa is, where there is an idea where I think if you asked a number of Trump administration officials, they would say that there are Antifa membership cards or that there's some kind of mailing list or something like that.
Who's paying members?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that's, I think that was something that Earth First really largely abjured and I think went even farther with the ELF. But you're absolutely right about that.
I have one other question about the model, and then I want to get into some of the actions. But could you actually explain the book clubs and how the book clubs worked?
Yeah, so one member of the ELF, to the degree that it had members, William Rogers, who was somebody who was very well read. He was a guy who would put out readers on radical environmentalism, on deep ecology, on sabotage, as a way of just disseminating information to people. Got this idea after he'd been in the group for a few years, was that it was really important to try and spread the ELF's tactics, to teach other people to make timers for incendiary devices, to teach them some of the security culture innovations that they developed. So he started these things which became called book clubs, where a number of activists, some in the ELF, some kind of out of it, gathered. And it was it basically did like a skill share, where they'd basically offer, share amongst themselves, in particular criminal tactics that were useful to the cause. Or somebody would talk about how to set up a dead drop email account that people could use. Okay, somebody would give a little demo on lock picking, or give a demo on assembling incendiary device timers. And it was a way of trying to spread the ELF's tactics to other parts of the movement, or to even if they wouldn't actually plan particular actions at book club meetings, but it was a way of trying to get other ELF cells to form or to share some of what they've learned.
It seems like in the book, William Rogers is also known as Avalon.
Yep.
It seems like Avalon is very big on creating zines that talk about how to do some of these tactics. And it also seems like the original cell members got a lot of their ideas from an animal liberation zine around the incendiaries.
Yeah, no. So the animal liberation, there's this whole amazing culture of zines around that were, there were a number of zines that were published in Eugene specifically, but some of the animal rights zines would include information on incendiary devices or tactics that could be used for sabotage. And this goes back to the Earth First, and the Earth First Journal would do this as well. They would occasionally print information about, they had a kind of complicated relationship to monkey wrenching, but they were not above printing diagrams for destructive devices that people could use to sabotage bulldozers or other agents of destruction. So both Kevin Tubbs and Jacob Ferguson, two of the founders of the Eugene Cell, got their designs for incendiary devices from these animal rights zines that were just being passed around within the movement. And they both separately got diagrams from these to blow up trucks. And then in Ferguson's case, a ranger station.
And I want to ask about the actions, but I actually have one other question about about some of the tradecraft, I guess you could say, is that a lot of the influence on the ELF cell, the Eugene cell is the most known active ELF cell in the U.S. But a lot of their influence comes from animal liberation movements and earth liberation, radical environmental movements, whatever, from the U.K., right? It's like where some of this began.
Yeah, it's a really good distinction. So the ELF actually began in the U.K., and it started at a meeting in Brighton in the early 90s, where for a Earth First gathering, and some people made the decision to basically break off. And Earth First had always had a very conflicted relationship with sabotage. Some members were for it, some members were against it. There were opposing editorials in the Earth First Journal. But in this case, a number of people at the meeting just said, we're going to just go really hard with sabotage. And so we're enough so that we're going to actually break off from Earth First and start our own thing, which we're going to call the ELF. And it took a few years for it to reach the United States, but they eventually, a few years later, they published an article in the Earth First Journal when it was headquartered in Eugene, basically calling on activists in the United States to adopt their tactics. And they said, hey, we're the ELF. Here's what we do. If you want to pushing for sabotage, and if you want to be in the ELF, all you have to do is basically start burning things down. And some members in the U.S. began to do that. And that was the cell I focused on, the Eugene cell, which was the first folks in the U.S. to take that up.
And what was their first action?
It depends how you date it, but it was actually probably the first action that was officially announced for the ELF was by a guy named Jacob Ferguson and a woman named Josephine Overaker, who were both activists in Eugene. And they were driving past in a ranger station one day when their car broke down, and they'd been involved in the movement. They'd both been at Warner Creek, and they were a little frustrated and were trying to decide to bring things up a notch. And they got this idea of burning this ranger station down. So they returned a couple weeks later, and I should explain that ranger stations at the time did all the things that we think of as the ranger stations was doing, like where they would guide lost hikers or collect information about the forest, but they were also the sites of logging auctions. Huge amounts of our national forests are used for commercial logging, and the federal government would hold auctions for particular tracts of forests, which would usually be held at these ranger stations. So there's this feeling among activists that the Bureau of Land Management, which ran the ranger stations, were complicit in this clear cutting. So they would become the objects of frequently of protests among activists in the Pacific Northwest. And Ferguson and Overaker, though, decided to try and burn one down. And they actually attempted to burn one down in Detroit, Oregon, which was unsuccessful. They ended up torching a truck, but they left some ELF graffiti that the law enforcement respondent had no idea what this meant. And then a couple nights later, along with Kevin Tubbs, they successfully burned to the ground a ranger station in Oak Ridge, which was about 20 miles south, which at that time was the really did catch the FBI's attention because it was the, I think it was the largest destruction of federal property since the Oklahoma City bombing. So they very much paid attention to that one. But those were the two kind of first ELF, official ELF actions that occurred in the United States.
And there's a couple of them that I would say are like, there are many actions that happen. I've heard as many as 30 or more. I don't know the exact count, but
it's a little bit difficult to count because the cell that I looked at based in Eugene probably did about 10, 12 arsons, but then there were a number of other ELF cells that were smaller or but carried out a number of other actions in the United States in the early 2000s. So it's a little bit tricky because some of those incidents were much more publicized than others. Some, there was a lot of credit taking. Others were, it was a little bit more ambiguous. But yeah, 30 was probably, would probably not be a
I think I'd heard guess. Leslie Pickering say that at some point.
Leslie Pickering is an authority on this. So I would totally believe in there.
But there's a couple of related to the Eugene cell that are like somewhat pivotal. The Vail Ski Lodge arson seems to be like one of the most pivotal, if you could just talk about the significance of that.
To give a little background, Vail was this in Colorado was this famous ski resort town. And in the early 90s, a hedge fund bought up a number of resorts in Vail and began to rapidly expand them, which upset locals no end and angered environmentalists. And at one point on the very top of Vail Mountain, there was a lodge called the Two Elk Lodge, which was a ski resort, and Vail Resorts decided to expand it. And this would require clear cutting hundreds of acres of forest to expand the ski trails. It would also encroach on a territory of an endangered lynx. And this pissed people off a lot. And it became the subject of a number of articles in the Earth First Journal as people tried through legal means to stop the expansion to no luck. There were lawsuits filed. The Sierra Club got involved. There were protests, but no dice. Some members of the ELF decided that given that legal means had failed, this was a perfect opportunity to use arson as a way of trying to actually forcibly stop the expansion. A number of them went west and set about burning down this ski resort at the top of Vail Mountain. And it was logistically just immensely difficult. There's the town of Vail is already very high up, but the actual top of Vail Mountain is about another 3,000 feet high. There's one windy road to get up there, which was actually at the time of year in which they were attempting to do this had been completely blocked by snow. So the elves ended up having to carry by hand hundreds of pounds of fuel up the mountain, just through snow and trying to avoid being seen by security guards and hunters. And it was a immensely difficult logistical challenge to the point, but they succeeded. They ended up burning down this entire lodge, which consisted of, I think, 11, 12 different structures, including a ski lift, a giant cafeteria. It was logistically complex that the FBI, when they first got on the scene, assumed that it had been done using helicopters, because they could think of no other way in which they could have actually gotten up there. But it was at the time the largest act of eco-sabotage in U.S. history. So at this point, the ELF had been on the FBI's radar for a little bit, but at that point, they became a top priority because it was just a huge embarrassment to the Bureau to have this spectacularly brazen arson happen and to have no idea who'd done it.
And just playing off of an earlier question I had is we had a movement in Colorado, which was against this expansion, but the folks in the ELF cell had very little to do or nothing to do with that above ground movement, correct?
Yeah, no, they were not directly involved in the movement in Colorado. And actually the activists in Colorado who had been fighting against the expansion weren't particularly happy with the fire in the sense that it brought a lot of attention or unwanted attention from law enforcement on local activists who had not been very careful about not breaking the law, but a number of them ended up being grand juried, which is never fun. And there was this sense that the ELF had parachuted in and tried to involve themselves in a problem that they really didn't have any right to be involved in.
And this is the action that really puts them on the radar of the FBI, like nationally. And this is pre 9/11, right?
This was in 1998. And it was something like a year before the director of the FBI, Louis Frey, had given an interview where somebody had asked him about what they called eco-terrorism. And he'd said very candidly, it's not really on the radar. And then after Vail, which led the nightly news, there was became a plot point on the West Wing on one episode. It was all over. FBI at that point decided we really got to solve this thing.
Okay. And then the other pivotal action, which is really key to the ELF story, is around there's two arsons at the Joe Romania Chevy dealership, which is like the second one is what brings about the undoing of the cell, correct?
Yeah. So there had been an initial, the Romania Chevrolet was an SUV dealership in the center of Eugene, Oregon. And in 1999, two activists, Jeff Lures and Craig Marshall, had decided to set fire to one of the SUVs as a protest against global warming. And they were very quickly caught. They had been, unknown to them, they had actually been being tailed by a local police officer at the time that they committed the arson. So they were very...
They'd been part of a local tree set as well. So they were under surveillance because of that.
They were under surveillance because actually there'd been a anarchist protest the year before that had a carnival against capital that had caused a lot of property destruction. And it was actually it was about a year later, and the anarchists and Eugene had said openly that they were going to do it again. So the Eugene Police Department put a number of local activists under surveillance, and Craig Marshall and Jeff Lures were prominent tree sitters and were very much involved. So they had a undercover police cars following them that night in the hopes that they would lead them to an anarchist party, which was supposedly, according to the cops, sometimes ended in property destruction. But instead, they went and they committed this arson at the Romania dealership. So after Lures and Marshall were arrested, some members of the ELF decided, even though they were not official ELF members, decided that as a show of solidarity, it would be a good idea to finish what they'd started and go and set fire to Joe Romania Chevrolet again. They ignored the fact that actually Lures and Marshall had very intentionally set fire to just one SUV as a kind of symbolic protest against, like, gas-guzzling American cars. Yeah. But the ELF decided, let's just torch the whole lot. So I think they set out this new kind of complex design that was decided using knotted towels or folded towels, like soaked in gasoline, and allowed them to torch something like 3 dozen SUVs all at once. And it caused a huge amount of destruction, but it also ultimately led to their being caught by the FBI, or was a concatenation of events that happened afterwards that led to the cell's undoing.
Yeah, and it was the second, it was the ELF one, not the Marshall and Jeff Lures one, which ended up putting Jacob Ferguson on their radar, on the police and FBI's radar.
Yeah, so it was a funny coincidence. The FBI had been through looking at Ferguson's on and off again partner, Josephine Overaker, for a number of reasons, but she was the only suspect they had who was actually in the ELF. The FBI went through a number of suspects that never really panned out, but Overaker was the one suspect who they were actually right about. But Jacob Ferguson was not actually involved in Romania at all. The cell, he lived in Eugene, and the cell intentionally left him out of this action because they didn't want to attract suspicion to him. They knew that he was already known to police, and they thought it'd be a good idea if they just didn't even tell him about the fire they were going to do, so he didn't have any opportunity of being arrested for it. Unfortunately, in not telling him about the fire, he didn't have any kind of alibi that night. So through happenstance, he ended up being the FBI's chief suspect for the Romania fire, which they were totally wrong about, but they were completely right about him being in the ELF.
And it seemed like a leader
Yeah.
Made.
So they didn't really know. Jacob Ferguson was cross-punk. He had gotten involved in activism when he'd moved to Eugene after he'd kicked a heroin habit and was looking for something else to occupy his time. And he was always good. Before the FBI arrested him, they'd always underestimated him. And they thought that he was this guy who had been involved in Romania, but they didn't really have any sense of kind of his, to look at him, he didn't look like the leader of any kind of movement. When they ultimately arrested him, they found out that he, in fact, had been with the cell from the beginning. He'd been participating in more fires than anyone. And he was actually quite deeply involved in the cell's formation and really critical to it for many years.
And if you see the film, If a Tree Falls, which is actually on YouTube, which I've just recently rewatched, Jacob Ferguson is in it because what I'm going to ask about in a minute, but Jacob Ferguson is very much this classic bad boy punk. He's in bands. He has a pentagram tattoo on his head. It's and also very much doesn't fit the demographic of who other members of the ELF were as well. He's like, he lives on the street. He was an itinerant anarchist kid.
Yeah, he was a guy who had been, before he'd gotten involved in activism, he was going around the United States hopping trains and scoring dope and living in squats. A lot of the ELF people who were involved had much more traditional backgrounds where they'd gone to college, they had middle-class jobs, they were involved in activism, but they had grown up in stable middle-class families. So Ferguson was the only one who looked like the cops' imaginary conception of an eco-terrorist, which is part of the reason he got more law enforcement attention than the other folks who just did not look like how police imagined a saboteur was supposed to look.
And then they flip him, and then he spends the better part of a year going around wearing a wire on his old friends.
Yeah, so a little bit of a spoiler here. So the FBI basically convinced Jacob Ferguson to work with them in exchange for a more lenient sentence. And what that involved for them was, in exchange for immunity, Ferguson agreed to wear a wire. And at this point, about 2004, 2005, the cell had been broken up for some years. They had broken up shortly after 9/11, when it was clear that what they were doing wasn't working and just wasn't sustainable at that point. But so the FBI wired Ferguson up and sent him around to orchestrate it so that he would run into his old colleagues and he'd go up to them and say, "Hey, you remember when we used to do fire crimes?" And they would, some of them, in keeping with the ELF's first rule, would absolutely not talk about it. And some of his colleagues did. And the FBI was able to get a number of people making these very incriminating statements on tape. And it led to a number of arrests of people who'd been in the group.
And I think you talk about there's four who don't cooperate.
Yep.
Out of 19. One goes to trial, which I was unclear what her status was. But there's a number of people, they name names, basically. And
I think it should be emphasized that everybody ended up talking to the FBI in some regard. Everybody had a conversation with the FBI. I don't think there's anybody who didn't get a 302 that was ultimately that came from an interview with them. But some people, agreed to provide names of colleagues and say, this particular person was involved in this particular action. And a minority of folks refused to do that or were unwilling to, would talk about what they did or actions they were involved with, but they refused to actually say, to discuss the role that other people had played or to incriminate others. But it was a torturous choice for all of them, because all of them had these incredibly, so one of the things that came out of the first Romania arson was Jeff Lures, who Craig Marshall decided to plead down his role in the destruction of the SUVs. Jeff Lures did not, and he ended up getting initially for the crime of destroying a handful of SUVs, 23 years in prison was right. The initial sentence. It eventually came down, but it was the longest sentence for eco-sabotage that had ever been set out. So the idea when these arrests came down, a lot of the elves were facing life in prison. And at that point, there was a belief that that was not for show, that the federal government really was intent on imposing those kinds of decade-long sentences. So a lot of them faced this choice of either cooperating and potentially avoiding the very worst punishments that they could face, or naming names. And I think all of them really struggled with that.
And the max people got were like 12 years, 13 years.
Ultimately, yeah, I think that was Stan Meyerhoff, who had been instrumental in the construction of the incendiary devices, ended up pulling the longest sentence at 13 years.
Right.
Although he was actually the first person to after Ferguson, to cooperate or to name names.
And many of them are out of jail, but are because of this, are like persona non grata in radical environmental circles for people who were around back then and people who know the story. And could you talk a little bit about why the folks who had named names and cooperated more fall into that?
Yeah, so after the arrest came down, it had a just enormously destructive effect on the radical environmentalist community in Eugene. At the end of the day, social movements are a set of relationships. And realizing in the aftermath of the arrests, activists, when they heard about Jacob Ferguson, who had been well known within the movement, who as somebody who had gone and betrayed everybody, it caused just an enormous amount of fear from people about who, and doubt about who they could trust. And so there was a kind of closing of ranks at that point. And when additional people began to cooperate, it created a huge number of conflicts where some people took a more sympathetic view of people who chose to name names, and other people felt that in order to maintain the movement's integrity, those activists, whatever they had contributed at one point, needed to be shunned. The people who supported them needed to be shunned. But so I think there were real ramifications beyond simply helping put other people in jail. It really created a cloud of doubt around everything. It made it very difficult to recruit people, and people began to scale back their tactics. It was just a really dark time.
And this is mid-2000s.
Mid-2000s, yeah.
And there's some other big name radical animal rights cases going on as well. The Shack 7 is also happening in this similar time.
Yep.
People targeting, the feds targeting Rod Coronado. And so it's not just this Eugene cell.
Yeah, no, there were a number of cases that were happening at this point. And it was a government after 9/11 was coming down on all forms of illegal protest within the radical environmental movement and in other political movements very hard. So this period of time came to be known as, Will Potter's called it, the Green Scare. Sure. And didn't really have the same kind of scale of the Red Scare. But it was, I think the sort of level of fear was the same.
Yeah, Will often talks about the chilling effect.
Yep, very much.
That's actually one other thing that sort of plays into here, which I didn't get into sooner before we got into the actions and the investigation. But 9/11 plays a pretty significant role in resources for the investigation, but then also the chilling effect begins before the Green Scare because it comes in the sort of post-9/11 period.
It was 9/11 changed a number of things. For the FBI institutionally, it moved it, as we've talked about, from a organization that whose main goal was fighting crimes that had already been committed to an organization that's dedicated to preventing terrorism. And that meant that it was not only arresting people who had already committed offenses that they understood as terrorism, but they were trying to prevent terrorism from happening. And that meant more proactively infiltrating a number of movements or launching investigations before anything bad had happened, which had, as you said, an enormous chilling effect on a lot of these groups. And it was also more than that, there was a real shift in national mood about what was considered an appropriate way to protest. Whatever appetite that Americans had for property destruction, or that larger mainstream, let's say, environmental groups had for property destruction or for illegal tactics, after 9/11, everybody got very conservative. There was not a place in the national appetite for people burning things down. Mainstream groups became very reluctant to deal with radicals or to associate with them or to offer support or funding. And so it meant everything got really dialed back. And I think that had long-term effects on what people on both radical environmental movement and environmentalism as a whole, where they really just dialed back what they were, what they could aim for.
Just to bring it up to current times, towards the end of the book, you dedicate part of the last chapter or the epilogue to current events connected to this. And you talk about how the ELF may have been more prescient than originally thought, because we've entered into this period where we're seeing sabotage, right? We saw sabotage with Dakota Access Pipeline last year. When this takedown Tesla movement was going on, we saw a lot of burning of Tesla vehicles. Mm-hmm. This year we saw where someone set this Kimberly-Clark warehouse on fire in Southern California over economic justice reasons. But Kimberly-Clark is also a terrible forest destroyer too. I just know that from my other life.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I'm wondering, could you say a little bit more about what you meant by that?
Yeah, I think even more broadly than sabotage, I think one of the precepts of the ELF was the idea that change within the system or change through politics by traditional means just was not cutting it or just was not working. There was a very sort of clear-eyed understanding at the time about the kind of destruction that we were doing to the planet and the fact that the reforms that people were seeking at that point were just not cutting it, that there was just not going to be a way of changing things fast enough to make a difference. And that I don't think anybody thought that arson or that the program of fires was a surefire or was in a I don't think that anybody in the ELF thought that arson was a magic solution to this, but I think it was an understanding that everything else that we were doing was not working, so they needed to try something else. And I think one of the things that's happened in the last 20 years is that a lot of people have come around to the ELF's idea that it's impossible to make change through within the system, that it's impossible to do what needs to be done through traditional methods or through, I think if you were to say,
through politics as usual.
Yeah, through politics as usual. And I think it's interesting the degree to which people, I think 20 years ago, who would be scandalized by the idea of setting something on fire as a protest, I think a lot of people have come around to that as, if not a solution, something that feels within the realm of possibility or feels within as good an idea as any other. I don't think you have to be a radical to think that. I think most of NBC's viewership thinks that now. And I don't think most of them are setting fires, but I think there's a real sympathy for it.
People on the right would argue that those tactics are fine for if it's in the furtherance of their causes.
Yeah, no, terrorism.
They stormed the Capitol.
Terrorism is only when other people do or people do violence in support of a cause you don't like. There's not a hard and fast definition of that. And it's one person's liberatory property destruction is another person's terrorism. And it's not like it's very hard to maintain a consistent definition of that word.
We're getting towards the end of our time. One other kind of final question is, you talk about how the cell eventually dissolved over what seemed like a debate about assassination. And now we saw someone assassinate a CEO here in the last year and a half, and who has been in some quarters hailed as a hero, right? Luigi Mangione. And I'm curious if you think that we've also, similar to what you were just talking about, but like we're seeing a sea change on that as well.
I think people are very receptive to political violence in a way that they weren't not 20 years ago. I think whether it's setting things on fire, whether it's assassination, and it all comes again from an understanding that, or correct or not, that politics as usual is not solving the problems that need to be solved. And I think there's a real sympathy for vigilantism or politics by other means. And I think that it, Mangione is an interesting case because it's a people have loathed the health insurance industry and what it does to medical care for decades. And it is, from the perspective of an American voter, an utterly unsolvable problem. There's nothing I can do or nobody I can vote for that is going to make that better or that is going to fix that or is going to anytime soon. And so I think when you're in a situation where problem is unsolvable, then a violence becomes a newly attractive option.
The other thing I think about with Luigi, and I think about this in regards to the ELF, and I guess this is my last question, is through history, we've seen sabotage used lots of times in the context of a movement. I find it interesting that the ELF dropped out of the movement, and like in Colorado, for example, they weren't connected to the people who had been protesting the ski lodge. Similar with Luigi, it's not Luigi didn't come out of, he came out of the tech industry, right? He didn't come out of movements. And I just see this disconnect. I feel like sabotage is an important thing when it's in the context of this broader man rooted in it. First Nations people in Canada dismantle bulldozers all the time. That happened at Standing Rock, right? But like when it's disconnected, I feel like that's when some of the problems arise.
Yeah, this was the Andreas Malm criticism of the ELF, was basically that they were doing this off by themselves, but they were not part of a larger political movement that could capitalize on what they were doing, as opposed to, let's say, arson as used within the civil rights movement, or arson used by the ANC and the anti-apartheid movement, where they were radical flanks of a existing political movement that also was trying to achieve parallel change through other means. I hear that. I think it's also a question about what is the purpose of spectacular violence without endorsing. And I think when Luigi Mangione killed the CEO, it did create a discussion around the insolvable problem of healthcare and expressing frustration publicly that I think the effects of which are hard to chart and are pretty nebulous. But the same way for the ELF. I don't know, the Vail Resort was rebuilt. At the same time, the effect of having a ski lodge on fire on national television and bringing the concept of arson as a tool for political change and defense of the environment to millions of people who might not otherwise hear about that. I think it's a difficult thing to say whether the ultimate effect of that, or if the only kind of sabotage that's helpful is when it's in furtherance of a already established political movement, or whether it can't do a few different things.
I'm gonna wrap it there. Actually, you want to tell us where to find the book?
Yeah,
and when it's coming out and where to find it.
The book is coming out on June 23rd from Viking. Pre-orders are available now. You can order the book for people who you think would love it. You can also order it for people you think would really be angered by it. I think the important thing is to order many copies. But it's available from your local bookstore. It's available from bookshop.org. I'm very excited to have you read it.
Yeah, I got to read an advanced copy, thanks to Matthew. It's a very compelling story, and I think it's an important commentary on what happened 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and what we're facing with today. So I highly recommend the book. And the book, once again, is Fires in the Night, The Earth Liberation Front, the FBI, and the Secret History of Eco-Sabotage.
Thank you so much for reading it, Scott, and thank you so much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure talking about it.
Yeah, it's been great talking with you. And for folks out there, if you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit the subscribe button. If you're listening to us on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit the support button, or become a patron, patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And until we talk again, everyone out there, make trouble and misbehave.